In the end, I did get one more student in that class. But one of the two boys who hated the other dropped out of school about halfway through the semester, so that kept us at our limit of 30, perhaps at his expense, and we struggled along as best we could. But parents don't send their children to school to just struggle along. And I was discouraged by how that class went. The big lesson for me, though, was to really appreciate that contract that I was sent to read. Without it, I have no doubt that things could have been much worse. There is, of course, a price to pay for this kind of protection of the students' best interests. The protection of their right to decent class sizes and to a fair share of their teacher's attention means that students arriving at the school may not have access to a given class of their choosing, or even to a grade level in a class they require. I've seen this very situation occur at Fernie Secondary School where I teach, and it's a very unwelcoming experience for parents and children, no matter how many apologies and alternative educational arrangements are offered. This lack of flexibility, some critics put forward as an argument against class size limits. But the solution to this problem is not to trample on the rights of the students already in the classes. The solution is to staff schools with a view to meeting the needs of all the students, not meeting some arbitrary funding formula that does not take their needs into account. Each school is unique. It might be an inner city school struggling to accommodate a large number of ESL students, or a special lunch program, or a gang investigation officer, or a small town school like mine, trying to keep senior high elective options viable without giving up its librarian like we've had to do for the last 2 years. Schools are human institutions, and they must be staffed for the programs they require. The solution is not to always downsize, but to analyze and then fund accordingly. If any flexibility is required in BC's school system, it is flexibility in funding. In fact, although flexibility was one of the big arguments for tearing up teacher contracts, the loss of teacher control over class size has not made things better. This fall, all around the province, schools complied with the government's demand that class sizes be counted and reported. Above the primary level, at which there is some recognition of the importance of class size limits, we have 9,000 classes of 31 students or more. 9,000. And the students and teachers in those classes are supported by fewer counselors, fewer teacher librarians, fewer child care workers, fewer integration support specialists such as speech pathologists, and more narrowly limited definitions of what it means to require special needs or ESL support. Ironically, the teachers in these large, minimally supported classes are faced with much higher expectations for individualized instruction, increased literacy levels, increased numeracy levels, utilization of ever-changing technologies, high-stakes standardized testing, and responsibility for the often demanding social and emotional needs of the current student population. Add to this the closure of 122 schools and the condensing of 14,000 students into fewer schools farther from their homes, their sense of safety. The impact of this provincial decision really hit home for my family when our son was one of these displaced students 2 years ago after the school across the street from our house was shut down. Despite government promises that parents would be able to choose their children's schools, we were not able to do so. The classrooms were overfull, and the principals wanted to balance, the two remaining elementary schools wanted to balance them as best they could. So our son sat for 2.5 days in the library at one of the schools while they decided into which class of 33 he would be the 34th student. Eventually, he was able to join the class of his choice in a classroom designed for about 25 desks at the most. It took our pack almost 4 months of lobbying to have a wall removed so that the students could have some space between their desks and the teacher could walk around the room. That is not progress. It is the price of what is euphemistically referred to as flexibility. And unfortunately, our experience was typical of what happened with school closures all around BC. Being an English teacher, I'm all too aware of what averaging rather than limiting class size, could do to students. Nearer to the end of my career now, I find myself at a school with declining rather than booming enrollment. But the number of staff removed as our school shrinks has been disproportionate to the number of students lost, to the point where many courses and programs have totally disappeared. For example, we used to have both Writing 12 and English 12, or English Literature 12, even though our grad class of about 100 students, there were usually only 10 to 15 students who would take these courses. Now we rarely offer both in the same year. And in many years, we offer neither, because that level of student enrollment is now considered too small to justify the use of teacher time. This type of loss is cross-curricular. Geography has been lost too. French 11 and 12 are combined in the same classroom as our Physics and Calculus 12. Band has four grades in a class of 30. Clothing and foods have a similar situation, and so on. My daughter in grade 12 this year had a tough time to find enough suitable courses for her graduation plan. It's pretty difficult to have a well-rounded transcript in rural schools these days. It's even difficult sometimes to get all the courses required for university entrance. Nevertheless, it is the junior high students in core subjects who tend to pay the highest price of the class averaging gain. Elective courses, which spread the students over a wider range of options, are likely to be offered at an enrollment of 20 plus just to keep them alive. That means that core courses, especially at the junior level, are filled to the brim. Once upon a time at Fernie Secondary, we had something called the Happy Grade 8 Program. It was our vice principal's name for it. Cute. But it involved a lot of liaison meetings, orientation meetings, and special activities, and a guarantee that no grade 8 student would be in a class of more than 24. This program provided for the grade 8s with a special profile in our school, and it gave them the extra help they needed to make that transition into high school from elementary. But with cutbacks in education funding, that program disappeared like many other great ideas. And last year, in grade 8, our son did not have one class under 30. Not one. A popular solution for this problem is to offer a webcast version of some of the elective courses, with students in four schools and a teacher in only one. This will require the harmonizing of the timetable in all these schools, despite dramatically different pupil enrollments, staff profiles, and school cultures. We have barely kept our senior electives alive through creative timetabling, utilizing our staff's talents as best we could. I hate to think what will happen when we have to harmonize that tight timetable with three other tight timetables. I have been asked to deliver either Writing or English Literature 12 as a webcast course. I have no experience with such teaching and no idea how the cooking show variation of course delivery will work. But I strongly suspect it will not serve the best interests of the students. It seems to me like a techno band-aid on a self-inflicted wound. I expect it will be much more likely to lead to teacher layoffs than to reduce class size in junior core courses. Because language arts is the core course, which all students must take throughout their school careers, K-12, I think it provides us with a really good insight into the impact of lost class size limits. Over the last few years, methodology in English has become very student-centered, following significant research on literacy development. So, rather than having 30 students reading the same novel and completing the same set of study questions, an English teacher is now more likely to have literacy circles, studying a certain group of novels, different novels for each group, or self-selected individual novel studies. Cooperative learning groups and partner study have become standard. Study questions have been replaced by journals, projects, presentations. Isolated skill instruction involving grammar sheets and spelling lists and disconnected essay assignments have been replaced by portfolio assessment, writing conferences, mini lessons in mechanics, and integrated themes. It's a lot more fun being an English teacher now. and it's a lot more fun being a student in such a classroom. And all of these strategies are excellent for complex class composition because they're student-centered. It's precisely the uniqueness of each student's individual response that is valued. The student's ability to explain their own thinking in relation to the material under study, their ability to demonstrate learning in different ways, to consider their own success in relation to task criteria. These approaches leave much more room for setting a wider range of a wider range of classroom challenges for different students. But this approach to teaching is also much more demanding. It's really labor intensive, and it's nearly impossible when you have large classes, especially if you have several or most of your classes that are large. So successful student-centered instruction really requires that a teacher have the opportunity to know the students well. Without reasonable class size limits, it'd be difficult for teachers to continue with many of these practices. So, what shall we trade for flexibility? Shall we abandon best practice in the name of class size averaging? Shall we abandon integration? Shall we accept lower literacy rates, lower numeracy rates, lower graduation rates, increasingly simplified curriculum? I don't think we like the sound of any of these trade-offs. But if we keep on the way we've been going in BC, we may have to accept them. I think it would be fair to say that when we lose a few undersubscribed electives that are near and dear to the heart of the postgraduate plans for only a limited number of students, we've already witnessed the death of the canary in our education mineshaft. But when we begin to face trade-off questions like those I've just outlined, we're accepting the fact that we now face the imminent collapse of the whole gold mine. And I'm from the Kootenays, and in the Kootenays, we don't take that mining analogy lightly. When I look at this semester's English 11 class, the one that just finished this semester, with 32 students in it, it's hauntingly familiar. It's very similar to that class I told you about earlier. And I realize that I can't as readily teach these students as creatively as I would like. And I can't meet all their needs fairly and equitably during class time. And as much as I really enjoyed this group of kids, I didn't get to know them as well as I would have liked to have. In addition to my sense of loss, I feel afraid for them. They do not have the same protection of their educational rights as that previous class enjoyed. And I wonder if we aren't headed back to a place in BC education that we should have left behind forever in that Science 9 class of 1968. I thank you for your attention this evening, and I ask that you keep some of these ideas in mind as you work through your sessions tomorrow. The work you do is crucial in making sure that every kid counts.